This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Nothing like opening up the show with a barrage of numbers, but these are some seriously eye-opening numbers. The Alzheimer's Association has estimated that by the year 2050, more than 16 million Americans will be living with Alzheimer's disease at a cost to the economy of over $1 trillion a year. On today's Health Show, we'll talk about Alzheimer's disease from a scientist's point of view and with some people from the association.
We'll hear about efforts to find new, non-invasive ways to detect Alzheimer's early. Learn about efforts at the NIH to try and unravel the genes that some think cause the disease. And find out what the Alzheimer's Association does to make the lives of Alzheimer's patients and their caregivers a bit easier. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. For the most part, Alzheimer's disease is a mystery. That's not to say that there have not been advances in detection and treatment of the disease, but I think it's safe to say that we are many years away from having Alzheimer's survivors talking about their treatment. But researchers have hopes and are developing new methods of detecting the condition earlier in efforts to treat people before dementia takes over. I recently spoke with one of those researchers, Dr. William Hugh, an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. He was part of a panel discussion about early detection of Alzheimer's, so I asked him about the test that may or may not exist right now.
As of now, there's no officially recommended screening for Alzheimer's disease in healthy people. We only start to screen when folks have the earliest memory symptoms. And in the clinical setting, we usually generally do a clinical neuropsychological testing, followed up by an MRI of the brain, which is a high-resolution scan of a picture of the brain. And then in the appropriate situations, we also recommend a spinal fluid test to see whether the changes consistent with Alzheimer's disease are present.
And what are some of those changes?
There are three proteins we look at, one having to do with one type of change in the brain called plaques, and two having to do with the other type of change in the brain called tangles. And the specific proteins are amyloid and total tau and the tau protein with a specific modification. Those are the three proteins we look at.
Okay. And what is coming up new that might be able to screen people for it a little earlier?
Well, as you may have heard, the amyloid scan was approved by the FDA, and there's also another scan that's undergoing FDA approval process. And the scan is a little less invasive, but it's a little costlier, and that could be potentially used in the future as a screening procedure for folks over a certain age or folks with certain risk factors, such as a strong family history of Alzheimer's disease, a history of head trauma, and so forth.
When you say scan, what type of a scan is it?
It's a PET scan. It's a functional scan, and you will need to be injected with a special dye that binds to the plaques in the brain. And then the doctors will then put you in a scanner and try to pick up any signal that's given off by the dye.
Now, that again, it involves radiation, and everyone is always hoping for something a little less dangerous than that. Tell us about biomarker tests right now. Right now, that's being done with spinal fluid, right?
Right. That is being done with spinal fluid, and we have done quite a bit of work here at Emory and as part of the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative. And the spinal fluid biomarkers, the amyloid protein and tau proteins, are fairly predictive of the underlying changes in the brain that are consistent with Alzheimer's disease. The spinal fluid is collected in a controlled setting, and it's an outpatient procedure. And in experienced hands, it's a very safe and well-tolerated procedure.
And of course, everybody's hoping for that, you know, blood test that tells all. Is that anywhere in our future, or is that just a dream?
Well, I think the blood test is very promising, and as we are, along with others, engaging a number of blood development and blood tests. At the same time, blood tests are much more challenging technically to perform than some of the spinal fluid tests, because the changes in the blood can reflect other things, such as heart disease, lung disease, and kidney disease, instead of Alzheimer's disease. At the same time, the blood tests need to undergo perhaps more validation based on current understanding. So I don't think the blood tests today are where the spinal fluid tests or even the PET scan are.
Okay. And let's just go back one more thing. We spoke of amyloid, and amyloid is very important in diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. Tell us exactly what that is and what it does to the brain.
So the amyloid protein is the main constituent of one of the hallmark changes in Alzheimer's disease called plaques. The amyloid protein is normally produced by the brain in small amounts. For reasons we don't quite yet understand, in some people, these proteins start to accumulate and form these things that are very difficult for the body to get rid of. And that's probably the earliest formation of an Alzheimer's plaque. And it is thought that these plaques may be toxic, and the modified forms of amyloid before it becomes a full plaque may also be toxic. And a lot of the effort in drug development is focused on removing the amyloid or removing a toxic species of amyloid in the brain.
Dr. William Hugh is an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta.
Researchers at the National Institutes of Health have found that the blocking of activity in genes specific to learning and memory is an early and potentially treatable event in Alzheimer's disease. From the NIH, Wally Akinso reports.
Reduced gene activity in the brain appears to be an early event affecting people with Alzheimer's disease.
The gene is called HDAC2.
Dr. Roderick Corriveau is an expert on Alzheimer's disease here at the NIH. He says HDAC2 is known to tighten up spools of DNA, effectively locking down the genes within and reducing their activity or expression.
Think of this string of holiday lights that's been put in a box at the end of the holiday season, and it's all bundled up in that box. In fact, it's a ball, and it's all tightly wound together. This tangled ball represents the genetic tools for making new memories and the unusable state that we find them in Alzheimer's disease.
In a NIH study, researchers found that HDAC2 accumulates in the brain early in the course of Alzheimer's disease in mouse models and in people with the disease.
This gene is involved in turning off genes that are involved in Alzheimer's disease by making them like the string of the holiday lights that are in a ball. And it's kind of like the gene is the box itself. Our ability to make new memories is put into this box and becomes all tangled up. And the study showed that when you take away the gene, all of a sudden the lights can come out and they can go into a long string again and they can be turned on and we can start to make new memories.
Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia in older adults and affects as many as 5.1 million Americans. In the most common type of Alzheimer's disease, symptoms usually appear after age 65. Dr. Corriveau says these findings could set the tone for new treatment for Alzheimer's disease.
Well, right now there's no drug or therapy that can cure, stop, or prevent Alzheimer's disease. The study is an important step in developing a new therapy or strategy for a new therapy, and this is a new therapy that would go directly to the genes that are important for making new memories.
Dr. Corriveau adds that their goal is to prevent the disease from occurring at all. For more information on this study, visit ninds.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso.
In early March, the Alzheimer's Association released its latest facts and figures about the extent of the disease and its toll. We've already given you some of those numbers, but listen to a couple more. They report that in the U.S., an estimated 5.4 million people are living with Alzheimer's disease, at least 800,000 of whom live alone. Many of these people are being taken care of by family members, who the association calls unpaid caregivers. The added stress to these caregivers adds hundreds of millions of more dollars to the country's health care costs.
The Alzheimer's Association has a program called Know the 10 Signs, Early Detection Matters. The Health Show's Joe Donahue is here to talk about that and other programs and services of the Alzheimer's Association's Northeastern New York Chapter with Program Manager and Support Group Liaison Karen Britt and Director of Development Teresa Setzer. He started by asking Karen Britt if these new numbers are a result of better detection methods.
In part, I mean, a lot of it does have to do with an increase in early detection, improvements in our diagnostic capabilities, but we also have a growing aging population. So simply put, more people are living to the age at which they're more likely to develop diseases like Alzheimer's.
So as an association, how do you even begin to try to tackle that?
Well, I like to think of it one person at a time. The more we're out there providing education and information to people who know someone with Alzheimer's or are living with it in their lives and providing support to those people who are caregivers through support groups and social opportunities, the more we talk about it, the better off we'll be.
When you look at the development aspect of this, is it specific per program or does it go into an overall fund in the sense of are you looking at funding for particular counties or particular areas or particular programs or do you look at it overall?
We look at it chapter-wide, and what's really exciting working in development for the Alzheimer's Association is, unlike other organizations that have a national base where all of the money is sent to national and
right.
it's directly for research, we are actually funding the programs and services in the communities in which we live and work. And I think that's a very important distinction, and it is what makes the support we get so crucial, because the residents in these counties are dependent upon the services we provide.
Karen Britt, as program manager, and you look at the services that you provide, those five core services, those being what?
The five core services are information and referral through our 24-hour helpline, care consultation, which can be done in person, over the phone, in email, which is a more individualized conversation about a family's unique experience, support groups, education, and safety services.
To generalize for a moment, in most cases, it is up to a caregiver and a family member to make these vital decisions, right? The patient, in most cases, depending on the severity, they're removed from it, aren't they?
After a while, the earlier a person is diagnosed, the more engaged they can be in the planning process. Many times, though, as you say, people don't get diagnosed until they're already a ways into the progression of the illness, because it's an illness that gets worse as opposed to better. And so there does come a point at which the family takes over decision-making, care decisions. But the earlier a person's diagnosed, the more of a participant in that decision-making process they can be.
Is this something that is often caught by a primary care physician through a regular screening or from a family member or from a caregiver who is noticing something just slightly different?
Usually the family, the people closest to the person experiencing the illness, are the first to notice changes. Oftentimes, even before, as you say, the person may be aware of them themselves, and then they bring that to the attention of generally the primary care physician.
What should we be noticing?
Change. And not just, oh, Joe forgot where he put his car keys this morning, but a pattern. But I use that example intentionally because everyone forgets things.
Right.
So if you were to become panic-stricken at each time you misplaced an item or forgot something, you'd be worried for nothing. But a pattern of change where you notice short-term memory loss, difficulty making decisions, loss of initiative, withdrawal socially and mm-hmm. personally, it's multiple changes over a period of time that signals that something's going on.
Because we so often think of this linked to memory. And,
mm-hmm.
and I know my mother, who passed away a few years ago, she was always concerned because same thing. I don't remember what I did with the keys, or I forgot to put the cheese and the lasagna or something like that. And she would be very concerned. And she would tell me this while she was doing the Sunday New York Times puzzle in pen.
Ooh.
And I would think to myself, well, all right, maybe you're okay.
Yeah, I would think the same thing, yeah.
but we think of it as a memory-related thing.
When really it's a global thing. People with Alzheimer's disease start out with memory difficulty, but also difficulty organizing their thoughts, communicating effectively. And so really it's a disease that over the course of time interferes with all cognitive processes.
one of those services you mentioned is referral.
Mm-hmm.
To who?
We are what's called a non-bias referral source. So we will sit down with the family and provide information about all the community-based resources that are out there to assist families who are living with Alzheimer's or dementia. So it could be neurologists, elder attorneys, home care agencies, residential facilities, multiple possibilities.
Teresa, you mentioned this of the programs that you have. Many programs, I notice, incorporate the arts.
They do. We have some really exciting new programs that we're working with in our chapter, one of which is Memories in the Making, which is based on utilizing art as a vehicle to assist those with Alzheimer's to communicate in situations where they've otherwise lost the ability to have conversations with their loved ones. An example would be that they would create some sort of a piece of art, regardless of whether it was pencil, watercolor, whatever, and it might not make any sense to the facilitator of the group. But then when their family members, caregivers see this, they can't believe the clarity of the drawing because it represents something very specific and meaningful in the family. And so what we're finding is that this vehicle is, in some instances, making the family members feel more connected to their loved one, wanting to visit more, feeling more engaged because they know that the person that they love is still there, and that the way it appears on the outside isn't the case.
Still to come, more of Joe Donahue's conversation with Karen Britt and Teresa Setzer from the Northeastern New York chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1264.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Our guests today are from the Alzheimer's Association's Northeastern New York chapter. The Health Show's Joe Donahue is speaking with Karen Britt, Program Manager and Support Group Liaison, and Teresa Setzer, the chapter's Director of Development.
Well, you know, you mentioned something that brings up a point that I think is fascinating, of visiting more. And I have my wife's grandmother is an advanced Alzheimer's and has been for many years and is 96 years old.
Oh, wow.
And is in a facility and is taken wonderful care of. And, the visits, we want to do those maybe twice a week. We want to go twice a week. And but it's something that you can find yourself putting off because you feel as though you're not registering.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't have that, it's discouraging and maybe discourages you from that next visit.
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the challenges of loving people with Alzheimer's is changing your expectations of how the relationship is going to flow over the course of time as their ability to communicate and interact with you is changed by the disease. So if you were to go and expect to sit down and talk with your loved one the same way you and I are talking now, well, that would undoubtedly be disappointing because that's no longer possible. I often tell caregivers to go with a plan. Go at mealtime, go with pictures, with props, with tools that you can use to engage her. And that will allow you to put off the visit less and to get more out of it.
Right.
It's also important for families that love people with Alzheimer's to connect with other caregivers. There's a certain support and empathy that only caregivers share because they're living a similar reality. And that's where our support groups come in as truly life-altering for caregivers.
And you find that that time of day really does have an importance. You know,
a huge factor, yeah.
And I guess this depends, but at a good facility, they'll tell you, you know, the best time to visit will be between 11 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a good time for her.
Yep.
And you'll go in and you really do see where there is some, I don't know, maybe recognition, but at least there is a willingness to communicate.
Absolutely. I think people with Alzheimer's, just like all the rest of us, get tired as the day progresses. And in their cases, it exacerbates the confusion and the anxiety that the disease has brought about. So morning does tend to be a better time to visit and engage with people with this disease.
What about the relationship with other people who have the disease? You go into a facility and you see many people who are in various stages.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have impact on other patients?
I think it does. You know, just as Teresa mentioned earlier, you know, that the art programs tend to resonate with the person that's still in there.
Right.
And I think that the people who live in these residential facilities, that's how they're connecting with each other. And it's interesting to me, having worked in long-term care facilities, to have observed myself the interesting relationships that the residents in these facilities develop with one another. It's fascinating.
All right. So how do you pay for it all?
Well, that's where the generosity of our community comes into place. Unlike other diseases, what makes Alzheimer's difficult is because there's no cure and there's no treatment for it. We don't have survivors in the same way that other diseases have survivors that can then champion and say, "Hey, join me." So we rely on our fundraising events, the largest of which is our Walk to End Alzheimer's.
Because when you look at all of this, I remember David Hyde Pierce, the actor who does a great deal of work with Alzheimer's associations and the disease itself, is him saying that it's hard to go into a group and find anyone who has not been touched in some way by this. And so I would think that would make it almost, not to say you have an easy job, but to connect with people, that it must be a little bit easier because so many people have a connection with it.
It is, and it's very enriching because even if you're at, a networking function or just going about your business and you're talking with someone, even if they aren't in a position to be able to become a donor of the organization, you're able to provide them with support, the reference of our helpline to call and get the resources that they need, and reminding them that they're not in this alone and that there are so many resources available because, you know, the Alzheimer's Association is here for the community and people need to take advantage of that helpline. Call us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Sometimes you need a specific question answered and sometimes you just need someone to listen. We have a wonderful person who's the best supportive listener that you could ask for, who will just be that ear if a caregiver is at their wit's end.
Yeah, you know, here's a program for you. I know you've got all this covered, but here's a program. Just have the doorbell ring and have the caregiver answer and just someone give them a hug.
Yeah.
They are the most amazing people, and it's what they do and out of the love that they do for the people and also for the men and women who are working in these facilities who work with it every day on a scale with such a love and compassion and joy that is really remarkable.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Some people are just, I think, born to work with this population.
Right.
It's so rewarding. Absolutely.
They should all have, like, fives in front of their salaries.
Yes.
Yes.
They don't, but they should.
But they should.
For what they do.
Absolutely.
They're remarkable.
Karen Britt is program manager and support group liaison, and Teresa Setzer is director of development of the Northeastern New York chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. They spoke with the Health Show's Joe Donahue. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.